Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Hong Kong says it is ready to begin talks with student demonstrators, and President Obama calls for the U.S. to avoid hysteria over Ebola. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Hong Kong's government says it will likely begin talks with student demonstrators Tuesday after nights of fighting between police and pro-democracy protesters have paralyzed parts of the territory. Hong Kong Chief Secretary Carrie Lam said Tuesday is the earliest of the 3 days the government gave to the Hong Kong Federation of Students. Riot police using pepper spray and batons fought with the pro-democracy protesters early today. Officials say 26 people were arrested, 15 police injured.
Unfortunately, these protesters chose to carry on with their unlawful acts, including unlawful acts which are even more radical, more violent.
In spite of saying the talks will begin in Hong Kong, Beijing continues to say they will not change a decision to vet candidates for the territory's 2017 vote. The U.S. and China have stressed the need to overcome mistrust, manage their differences, and cooperate on key issues such as combating terrorism and the spread of the Ebola virus. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and China's State Councilor Yang Jiechi pledged to address those concerns during a second day of talks today in the city of Boston. President Barack Obama is urging Americans not to give in to Ebola hysteria or fear because he says that people need to keep the situation in perspective.
Ebola is actually a difficult disease to catch. It's not transmitted through the air like the flu. You cannot get it from just riding on a plane or a bus.
President Obama said the 3 cases of Ebola already diagnosed in this country do not represent an outbreak or an epidemic, and that also note that 4,555 people are dead in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. This is VOA News. The Nigerian government says it will discuss with Boko Haram this week the terms for the release of more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by the militant group in April. The agreement was reached Friday by Nigeria's highest-ranking military official, General Alex Bada, who ordered all of the country's military chiefs to abide by the deal. Nigerian presidential aide Hassan Tukur.
I will say they have announced a unilateral ceasefire. Nigerian government has responded accordingly. And we are now monitoring to see if the ceasefire is holding, and I hope it will hold.
There's been no public comment from Boko Haram about any deal. Iraqi lawmakers today approved appointments of two critical posts. Khaled al-Obadi, a Sunni lawmaker from the northern city of Mosul, is the new defense minister. Mohammed al-Ghaban, a Shiite lawmaker from a powerful political bloc, has been elected as interior minister. The control over these two powerful ministries has been a source of tension between Iraq's feuding political parties. Iraqi lawmakers approved most of Mr. Haider al-Abadi's cabinet last month and officially voted him in as prime minister to replace Nouri al-Maliki. Russian and European leaders are describing difficult talks in Milan aimed at ending the crisis in Ukraine. Lisa Bryant has our story from Paris.
The talks among Russian, EU and Ukrainian leaders overshadowed a key summit between the European Union and Asia. Russian and European leaders said there had been some advances, although German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she saw no breakthrough so far, and the Kremlin spokesman described them as full of misunderstandings and disagreements. British Prime Minister David Cameron said what counts now is results.
Getting Russian troops out of Ukraine, getting heavy weapons out of Ukraine, and respecting all the agreements.
If that doesn't happen, Cameron said, the European Union must maintain sanctions and pressure on Moscow. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
Hurricane Gonzalo's winds and rains have knocked out power in most of Bermuda, plunging thousands of residents into the dark. The U.S. National Hurricane Service says Gonzalo has maximum sustained winds of 165 kilometers per hour, but is now moving off of the island. Forecasters say Gonzalo is headed north-northeast at 35 kilometers per hour, expected to pass near the coast of Newfoundland Saturday night or early Sunday morning. And the U.S. Air Force brought back another robotic space plane Friday after nearly 2 years of flight that are shrouded in mystery. The top-secret vehicle called X-37B landed at Vandenberg Air Force Base in Southern California. This is the third time the Air Force has launched a robotic space plane to orbit the Earth. It will only say the flights are risk reduction experiments for such reusable space vehicles. Similar to the now retired space shuttle fleet, I'm told it looks like a smaller version of a space shuttle. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We are busy inquiring because we think that they enjoy some complicity. And there is the inquiries locally.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has launched an inquiry into a recent attack in North Kivu.
The Zambia Congress of Trade Unions has resolved to stage protests to try and pressurize government.
Zambian workers threaten to embark on an indefinite strike action. We'll have details.
In Cote d'Ivoire, it's cocoa production, which is really all for export purposes, but also production in terms of rice output in Cote d'Ivoire.
And World Bank economists predict moderate growth for Africa's economy. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, launched an investigation into an attack in the North Kivu province that left at least 26 people dead and many injured, according to Information Minister Lambert Mende. The attack is blamed on the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, a rebel group originally from neighboring Uganda. Mende told me earlier that the government in Kinshasa is working closely with the administration in Kampala, sharing intelligence in a bid to end the violence carried out by the ADF rebels.
Till now, we are aware that this was a terrorist attack by ADF elements, those that have been defeated in rural areas who are trying to change, to modify their way of fighting. Now they are coming in the urban areas to attack civilians and run. This is pure terrorism.
So what is the government doing to protect the population, since, as you said, these terrorists have been defeated, but they are now coming to urban areas to attack the population there? What is the government doing about this?
We are busy inquiring because we think that they enjoy some complicity. And there is the inquiries locally, there is a fact-finding operation, and of course there is the operation to follow them, to hit them. We have lost even one element last night.
So that means you have increased troops in the North Kivu provinces following these attacks?
Our troops are everywhere in the province. This is a terrorist operation. They came from nowhere, they attacked and they ran. This is the modus they operate. So no one can say that there is a line where people are fighting or what. We have defeated them. We have taken control of their headquarters, and they are acting 2-3% here, 5 there. This is terrorism, as we know.
So basically they are using guerrilla tactics to attack the population. Is that what you're saying?
You have got it. That is it.
The government recently gave an ultimatum about all these armed groups should lay down their weapons to be part of the DDR program and all that. What happened to it?
This ultimatum is concerning Rwandese rebels of FDLR. They are in another part of North Kivu. They are not fighting as for now, but the ultimatum is running till the end of December, and we are starting military disarmament to force disarmament on 2nd of January. That is the decision that have been taken by our government, that have been backed by MONUSCO as well as all the Great Lakes states that will come to help. So this is something we are just hoping that these Rwandese rebels will cooperate before the end of December. So if this is not the case, on the 12th, on the 2nd of January, they are going to face a forced disarmament with all consequences.
Are you receiving any help from Uganda based on this latest attack, since these rebels are from Uganda?
Well, we are coordinating with our counterparts in Uganda, in terms of exchanging information. They are Ugandan rebels, but we can't say, they can't assume that those who attacked Beni are coming straight away from Uganda. They were in the bush in Congo, where they were defeated by our army, and this is a way of, I don't know, revenging or trying to last in Congo. But we are exchanging with our neighbors of Uganda any information about these criminals.
Lambert Mendy is DRC's information minister. He spoke with me earlier from the capital, Kinshasa. In Nigeria, there are reports of a ceasefire deal between the government and Islamist militant group Boko Haram. The agreement could lead to the release of more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by the group 6 months ago. Jumaid Mohammed is a social critic and former parliamentarian in the Nigerian Second Republic. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the northern Nigerian city of Kano by phone to find out what he felt about the ceasefire agreement.
I would love, like any other peace-loving Nigerian, for there to be some kind of proof, some cessation of hostilities between the Boko Haram terrorists, because this is what they are, and of course the so-called government of Jonathan Goodluck, which claims to be the legitimate government of Nigeria today. But having said that, I have this to say that, like most Nigerians, I have very serious doubts about the reality of this so-called truth. I don't even believe that we have had the complete story because, frankly speaking, the whole thing looks funny and sounds funny. And given the fact that Jonathan Goodluck is about to declare himself the sole candidate of his party, which happens to be the ruling party in Nigeria, very many Nigerians are thinking that the whole thing may be nothing but cheap and reckless politics.
Some people have said that one of the reasons this agreement has been possible is to enable the release of the girls captured from Chibok. But the Nigerian military has twice claimed to have rescued some of the girls, and at one time they said there were no girls abducted. So do people seriously think this is a genuine agreement?
No. Overall, the preponderance of Nigerians do not believe the government. And once there is a credibility problem between the government and the governed, you can see why people are not likely to believe them. First, when this president came to power, when the former president died, he said, and his spokespersons have said several times, that they are not in the business of negotiating or talking with terrorists. They have said that as late as last month. Secondly, we do not know, and we are yet to know, who were the people, who were the governments or institutions that were involved in these so-called negotiations, which led to the so-called truth, if indeed there was a truth. Because in any case where two people are fighting, or two countries, or two groups of people in different camps are fighting, we expect that when they decide to have a cessation of hostilities, for the terms to be known, for the people involved to be known, and for each responsibility to be determined on the part of the combatant or the fighting people. We haven't had that. It is not the business of the government to negotiate with people who have taken over these guns. Rather, it is the business of the government to get them out by whatever it takes. And nobody wants to see any of these guns put in harm's way. But whatever needs to be done must be done in order to see that these guns are home and are reunited with their loved ones and their families. That's our concern.
That was Jumaid Mohammed, a social critic and former parliamentarian. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kano, northern Nigeria. Supporters of Ghana's main opposition New Patriotic Party, or the NPP, are voting today to choose a presidential aspirant to lead the party in the next general election. Kwabena Ejepong, general secretary of the party, says the ongoing election has been peaceful. Ejepong told me earlier that the NPP will be ready to wrestle power from the ruling National Democratic Congress, or NDC, in the next election.
everything is going on according to plan. Party delegates are flowing through the various polling stations. There are 276 of them, one in each of the 275 constituencies, and a special polling center at the party headquarters for special delegates. Things are going very well, and there's quite a few hitches here and there that have to do with the identity of a few people which were not found in the registers that the IT department of the party produced for the Electoral Commission of Ghana. This election is being conducted with the Public Elections Act, and so therefore it is the Electoral Commission of Ghana that is in control of all the polling stations. And we do hope that by 8 o'clock Ghana time, they should have been able to finish with the coalition, by which time the Electoral Commission themselves would come and declare it, and the National Executive will introduce whoever wins at the Ifwa Sutherland Park later in the evening.
What is next after the flag bearer is elected by supporters of the party?
Well, that brings to the end our internal elections. So then we start preparing for the general election in 2016. Our constitution gave us up to December 6th. It's 24 months to be able to have a flag bearer in place. And today will be about two clear months away from that deadline. So then we start putting the structures in place, preparing the party to get into a campaign mode, to build the structures on the ground, to ensure that the party's machinery at the local level are capable of effectively and efficiently prosecuting a campaign to recapture power from the incompetent NDC administration.
Some members of your party are expressing concern that there appear to be some friction within the party, and they think that the prospect of the party could be hurt ahead of next year's general election if those appeared rift are not resolved. How do you address those concerns?
First and foremost, these are competitive elections. All over the world, presidential primaries generate heat. And so, therefore, there's been some heat generated. Some of the statements that have come from different camps have been unfortunate. But it's not the first time we've gone through this process. This party is perfectly capable of rallying around the winner. And we know that the most important thing is to ensure that we are an all-purpose party, a party that is determined to ensure that we recapture power for the sake of redeeming the people of Ghana. We are on a redemption mission, and most people will recognize that fact and submit any differences that may exist during this primary and put the party first. So I'm very confident that that should be an issue that will be behind us very soon.
Kwabena Ejepong is General Secretary of Ghana's main opposition New Patriotic Party, or the NPP. He spoke with me earlier from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Zambia Congress of Trade Unions, or ZSTU, is threatening to embark on an indefinite strike action and a series of protests later this month if President Michael Sata's government fails to lift an ongoing pay freeze for all public sector workers, according to Leonard Hikaumba, president of the group. Hikaumba told me earlier that members of the union would protest at the parliament building to send what the group said is a strong message to the lawmakers not to endorse the government's 2015 budget until the wage freeze is lifted.
The Zambia Congress of Trade Unions has resolved to stage protests to try and pressurize government to lift the freeze on salary increments and improvement on conditions of service for 2015. So the unions in the public sector are being encouraged by the mother body to organize the membership to participate in the planned demonstrations.
When do you plan on embarking on this strike action to put pressure on the government, as you said?
Well, these demonstrations are planned for the last week of this month so that we have enough time to make all the necessary arrangements.
Why now?
Yeah, following the declaration of the wage freeze last year, we had an engagement with relevant government authorities, and government agreed to engage into negotiations with public sector unions. So when this process started, we had to allow the process to come to an end. As we speak now, that process has not yet been concluded. Although the negotiations do not produce any tangible results, we wanted to see this process up to the end. And we continuously made submissions to government to lift the wage freeze. And especially for 2015, we made a submission to the budget that government should allocate some money for improving salaries and conditions of service. So when government did not take into account the submissions that we made and instead maintained the wage freeze, then we thought even the process that is going on of conciliation to try and resolve the dispute arising from the failure to agree on salary increments for 2014, then would just go ahead and start these protests, because we have seen that there is adamance on the part of government, and have gone ahead to maintain their position on not increasing salaries and conditions of service.
The supporters of the ruling party are saying that this is a calculated attempt by people in the trade union to embarrass the ruling party as well as the government ahead of the next general election. And this is done in collaboration with opposition parties to do this. What do you say to that?
Well, it has completely got nothing to do with the opposition political parties. This is purely an industrial issue. And it's purely a decision by the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions. And we are not in any way trying to decampaign, for lack of a better word, the ruling party. But it's just to fight for our rights, because we have indicated to them that a similar action of imposing wage freeze was done by government in 1998. That matter went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court made a ruling that imposing a wage freeze is illegal because it's against our own laws in Zambia. And this time around, we were reminding government that there is this ruling that was made by the Supreme Court, which government must respect. And, of course, we also complained that Zambia has a free economy where prices are not controlled, and that the commodity prices are ever increasing. So to hold the salaries and conditions of service static against prices that are rising would essentially be an act of reducing workers' salaries and undermining the conditions of service. So this is the basis on which this decision was made. It is completely got nothing to do with politics.
Leonard Hikaumba is president of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. World Bank economists predict much of Africa will continue moderate growth, a little over 5% over the next 2 years. But there are three exceptions to their forecast. The West African country is stricken with Ebola. The crippling effects of the virus on economic activity have put a damper on their once promising growth rates. From Washington, VOA's William Eagle reports.
World Bank figures are beginning to confirm the impact of the crisis on the economies of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. New data shows the service sectors of the three countries have been especially hard hit. The bank's latest report says wholesale and retail traders in Liberia report drops in business of up to 75% from the same period last year. It says gasoline and diesel sales in the country are down by 21 and 35% respectively. And since the onset of the crisis, hotel occupancy across the three countries is down by 13 to 40%. Economists say the public and political response to Ebola is affecting economic activity in the three countries. The Food and Agriculture Organization says about 90% of Sierra Leone's most productive plots are not being farmed, due in part, it says, to the fear among farmers of sharing tools and government restrictions on movement aimed at preventing the spread of the disease. Some airports are closed, as are the borders, which are crucial to merchants. Many people are afraid to go to West Africa's hot and crowded markets for fear of getting the virus. Ebola is spread by bodily fluids from an infected person. Sierra Leone and Liberia are recovering from long civil wars, and we're bouncing back with growth rates approaching 10%. Francisco Ferreira, the World Bank's chief economist for Africa, says response to the virus has put an end to the optimism, at least for now.
The fear they create, what we call the aversion behavior on other people, on farmers, miners, workers, consumers, that's really reducing GDP by between 2% or so this year in Guinea, more like 3.3%, 3.4% in Sierra Leone and Liberia, which adds up. Those countries are not rich, obviously, so those proportions add up to around $359 million in our estimates for this year.
Next year, he says, could be worse. If the outbreak is not controlled, affected countries could lose over $800 million. In response, the World Bank is mobilizing a $400 million finance package for the three countries. The money will go toward providing emergency response equipment and building field hospitals and treatment centers. It will also help strengthen healthcare systems, including monitoring of the outbreak. And the funding will provide general budgetary support for the Ebola-stricken countries, which are redirecting scarce resources to fight the virus. The economic forecast for the rest of Africa stands in stark contrast to that of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Growth is projected for most African states, despite a drop in commodity prices and slow global economic growth. The World Bank attributes economic expansion to public spending on infrastructure, a buoyant services sector, and a rebound in agricultural production for both export and domestic markets. Poonam Chuanpol is the World Bank's lead economist for Africa. She mentions two low-income countries where growth has remained robust.
In Cote d'Ivoire, it's cocoa production, which is really all for export purposes, but also production in terms of rice output in Cote d'Ivoire. In Ethiopia, agricultural production has gone up, both because of productivity increases and higher production. Production is also being supported in Ethiopia with spending in infrastructure. And so it's a range of factors, but yes, agriculture is providing a strong impetus to growth.
Chuanpol says Africa is bypassing industrialization as a means of promoting growth and jobs. Propelling the continent forward are services like tourism, transport, financing and telecommunications, and extractive industries like the mining of oil, gas, metals and minerals.
The extractive sector growth, I think it's something that has the potential to provide benefits to the rest of the economy because it is a source of income, which can then be used. The important thing is that how is the income from extractives distributed? To the extent that governments are able to get revenues from this and are able to redistribute it in terms of, spending it in infrastructure or for spending it for social programs to help, poor people, there are obviously benefits that can be derived from the extractive sector.
The World Bank says the manufacturing sector in Africa is lagging, but can contribute to growth. Its economists say for the continent, that means improving the business climate, curbing fiscal deficits, guaranteeing affordable energy, lowering transport costs, and building a skilled labor force. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
Sister blessing, we are the follow me go, all under mercy. Yes, I'm killing it, Mr. Melody, easy melody, yo.
And as you know, right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
We are the baby, I love you, baby. Never, never leave me, yo. I love you.
Personally, I rock your body. I promise you go home, you won't tell daddy. I give it to you like you never had it. Screaming your children like speaking Chinese. Now waiting me this, back a boom boom. Now waiting I see Zaga, cause she know one me. She talks so she know one me.
I know go lie, the things within my mind. When I see you dancing, girl, you got me high. And if you wanna try, make a good day tonight. Cause I'm in the mood, as long as you're feeling the good, I deal with you.
Personally, personally. Personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally, personally. Personally,
I go deal with you. I go deal with you
personally, professionally. I see what you're doing intentionally.
Get me wanted physically.
So give it to me radically. Emotionally, psychologically. You're turning me on biologically. Sexually, dramatically. And she talks that she know why.
I know go lie, the things within my mind. When I see you dancing, girl, you got me high. And if you wanna try, make a good day tonight. Cause I'm in the mood. As long as you're feeling the good, I go deal with you.
Personally, personally. Personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally, personally. Personally,
I go deal with you.
Yeah, exceptionally, no reason as spiritually, money speaking so drastically, magically, internationally, Abba, abatically, Rama, now for dictionary, Saga, so she know one me, she talks so she know one me.
I know go lie, the things within my mind, when I see you dancing, Mr. Giving you all you need.
Oh yeah, sorry waka, sister Shadewa. Sorry waka, open you up. Sorry waka, go all you up. Baby, go down when you go to. Sorry waka, sister Shadewa. Sorry waka, open you up. Sorry waka, go all you up. Baby, go down when you go to. Sorry waka, sister Shadewa. Sorry waka, open you up. Sorry waka, go all you up. Baby, go down when you go to. Sorry waka, sister Shadewa. Sorry waka, open you up.
Mr. DJ, what are you saying? Put us on a replay. After this one, put it back in replay. If you feeling this one, let me hear you say. Dash on the beat, double bang, stealing this. We don't count with the queen, we don't count for the street. Count with the twist, let it dance with your imps. Sense on the scene, now tell them what you think.
Don't take away, I come out, I want for dance, cha-cha. Body
DJ.
On Monday, now they dance floor. DJ, why you never relax for? Play that song and then they ask for. Ask for, ask for. On Monday, now they dance floor. DJ, why you never relax for? This not the song and then they ask for. Ask for, I say. No girl to girl or man to man. We don't hold on hand to hand. Fine body girl, let me BBN. Fine for me girl, make a BBN. Sexy girl, see me with them. Like Titanic, man, I sing with them.
Hey,
just to live like me for today, not live for tomorrow, cause you know where you wanna die.
right. Baby girl, come wild it, wild it. Baby girl, come move it, move it. Baby girl, come shake it, move it, drop it. Hey, show me what you got tonight.
Nasha!
She lay. Let me see your twist on the pop, now you come. She lay. On the biggest bench, girl, let me move her. She lay. Let me see your twist on the pop, now you come. She lay.
Lasha,
Lasha. Yo, girl, do we have fun tonight?
Yeah.
What you trying to do?
I'm rolling with you, daddy.
Oh, yeah? You gonna roll with me? All right, girl, let's go. What is this? Yo.
Again, oh,
Yeah. The way she's fine like a Indian. Now come the jumps like a Indian. Come the Jones like a Indiana. You never seen her before, I guess. You never seen the way that she wanna get. You never seen her dip it down low, spin her body like a turntable and suck her dress. I know you wanna know how she goes down low and the rhythm take control. I know you wanna know what she got me trapped in a limbo. That's what it seems. I wanna control it, girl.
I get this friend where we get from Calabar, Labake, Fade. Come to think she be my personal person. But anytime when she come around, she get this feeling where they do me like fever. And when she dance with my messy boo, he they be me like saying I for fana. Me like how she play the bass line. It makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she the way she that. It makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a drop. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it was me. That's what me talk say. I don't like this just touching body. But no say, my mama no like him. I don't want this shirt touching body. But no say, my papa no like him. It's an upset. Oh, na 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 na. Oh, na 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 na. Oh, na 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 na.
And that was our Saturday African Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for our Saturday commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to take my time to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. Every passing week, I devote a great deal of time to the headlines and see what is going on in U.S.-Africa relations. This week, I intend to look at U.S. policy in Africa and the impact of recent events. Number one, one can go back and look at the Africa summit, focusing on the good and bad of that summit. Number two, Ebola and its impact on U.S. relations with Africa. And lastly, a more recent development, the departure of our beloved Ali Imazuli from Kenya. Let's start with the first issue. The Africa Summit came and went. It was a major event, and people like myself and other people who are blogging or writing or broadcasting focus on the summit. There must be millions of citations on Google and other ways of registering what is going on in the internet with regard to the Africa summit. 5 points to remember with regard to the summit. Number one, as many of us have expressed in the media before, the summit was historical, not only for President Obama, but for the United States. And unfortunately, because of the Ebola, it adds a very interesting footnote to the Obama presidency, because the incident in Liberia with regard to a Liberian entering the U.S. and then unfortunately dying from Ebola takes us back to history. How those Americans who are very concerned about the end of the slave trade in the United States before it finally ended with Lincoln. Now the history of President Monroe, the history of Lincoln, and the history of the Kennedys and the Obama administration are now all linked together, because Monrovia is now identified with President Monroe. And interestingly enough, unintendedly, when President Kennedy died and you have a hospital named after him, many of the victims of Ebola were treated at the Kennedy Center. And President Obama is now running the United States. And under his leadership, he created a czar to be responsible for Ebola. This is a very interesting irony of history. The word czar is used to identify someone positively who will be the person given full power with regard to anything. It happened with Bush with regard to problems facing him at the time. So today, future historians of American policy towards Africa will connect the dots, and then they can see how America's relations with Africa deals with a number of issues and challenges facing the United States here and the people of the African continent over there. So when we talk about the Africa Summit, we can see how this summit provided an important development for America to assemble in these United States, the heads of states of Africa. It never happened before. It took place under the Obama administration. Those who are going to write the legacies of Obama will add this footnote to the main text of his leadership. The second issue that is very important, and that is the good and bad about this summit. The summit was significant in terms of the assembly of African hero states for the first time coming to the United States. But what must be borne in mind is results, results, results. Were you going to have a bone of contention between Africans who expected a lot from the Obama administration and those who did not expect much from the Obama administration? Is the frustration of many of the Africans who had exaggerated expectations from the president. But what many of them failed to realize is that Obama was elected by the American people, and the first port of call for him is America. Unfortunately, Ebola has entered the equation, and the president is using his presidential powers to make sure that his legacy and the American people will not be shamed with all the technological know-how, scientific discoveries in these United States. Africa dying from Ebola without American support would not tell well for Americans at the end of the century, because those people who are looking at the American century and are looking at the 21st century cannot miss this point, that at this particular moment in the history of the United States and the history of the world, a disease has come into the world scene, and America without American president is not able to do well. That is one of the reasons why people who are looking at President Obama and his activities must walk away from the equation by saying, this is the moment to engage Africa. Ideally, Africa and America must build higher levels of relationships in order to really develop the resources of Africa, the people of Africa, and to build that constructive bridge between the Atlantic for mutual economic development. This is where the good and bad about the Obama administration, the good and bad between American relations with Africa, the good and bad of African leadership in negotiating with America and the West and the world must be looked at critically.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Odette Frazier, as well as our engineer for today, Curtis Bynum, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Too many societies around the world place a far lower value on girls than they do boys. As a result, girls face often crippling discrimination. Their well-being, even their lives, are considered to be expendable. Too often, it is a girl who is first to drop out of school, the last to be fed, the last to receive medical care. This is not just unfair, it is detrimental to society at every level. Countries should ensure girls have equal protection under the law, protect them from violence and other abuse, and give them full access to education. Not only is this the right thing to do, it is the smart thing to do, since it would bring enormous developmental benefits that go beyond improving the lives of the girls themselves. Once an educated girl becomes an adult, she will earn some 20% more for each additional year of education she receives beyond grade 3 or 4. Statistics show she will probably share up to 90% of her earnings with her family and her community. She will marry and bear children later, and they will be healthier and more likely to go to school than will the children of women who have not received an education. Nonetheless, too often, families prioritize girls' help with household chores over studying or even attending school. Globally, 35 million girls have never gone to school, and only 30% of girls are enrolled in secondary school. 1 in 3 girls in the developing world will be married before turning 18, and 62 million girls are out of school, deprived of an education that would lead to positive health and economic outcomes. To empower girls and to draw attention to the unique challenges girls face around the world, in 2011, the United Nations General Assembly adopted Resolution 66-170, declaring October 11th as the International Day of the Girl Child. The resolution recognizes that empowerment of and investment in girls, as well as the meaningful participation of girls in decisions that affect them, are key in breaking the cycle of discrimination and violence and in promoting and protecting the full and effective enjoyment of their human rights. The United States fully supports UN Resolution 66-170. We believe that every girl in the world deserves to have a chance to live up to her dreams and aspirations. Promoting gender equality between girls and boys is not just the right thing to do, it is the smart thing to do.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.